So we are on lesson 18, and this is only covering really the first six verses. I know in your homework, all she covered was like verse 1, right? But we need to cover the first six verses so we understand what's going on there. And we're gonna start in a really strange place. We're gonna start in Genesis. In reality, all Scripture starts in Genesis. When we don't start in Genesis 1, we take it again out of context, and we don't realize what's happening. And this particularly happens in places like this. So we have Hebrews 13, and it begins with, love the brethren, remember the prisoners, show hospitality to strangers. And they all sound like, do this, do this, do this. And it sounds like you could actually just take chapter 13 and say, well, here's things we need to do. And that's always a problem when you take something out of Scripture and say, here's the list of the things we're to do. Always a problem. I don't care what part of Scripture you go to. If you do that and take it out of the context, you will begin to think that you can actually do these things. And then you will require other people to do these things. So we're going to talk about the question that we have as kind of pertains to that. So the question, Jill, you want to turn around and read the question there?
What happens when someone asks or expects you to do more than you are capable of doing?
So think about a situation where someone has asked or expected you to do more than you're really able to do. What happens
stressed.
To you? You get stressed.
Yeah.
What else?
Intimidated.
Avoid them.
So you avoid them. Okay, so now you're shoving guilt on top.
You know, I just think if it's a time thing, it's like I'll just do it. I'll find a way. I'll get no sleep. But say it's something like I want you to teach algebra 2 trig. I would be like, you just flounder.
Okay, so you flounder. So let's go back to the first one. So you go ahead and do it anyway, even though it's just beyond you. Then what happens? You're resentful and bitter, right? Yeah.
And you might have meltdown.
We never experienced this before.
No, obviously not. So let's go that even a little further. So you've done it, or you haven't done it. You begin to feel resentment toward that person. How does that start to come out? Beside a meltdown.
Maybe critical.
Ooh.
And I did it, and she doesn't even realize I did it.
Mm-hmm.
I distanced myself.
Yeah, avoidance of that person.
Okay. Anything come out beyond just between you and that person?
Oh, my family will tell you that. Mm-hmm. I take it out of that. You're mad about that, and now you're, you know, mm-hmm. I did nothing, it wasn't me.
So what is happening here? Exactly.
Well, self-trust.
Yeah. So this is why we have to start in Genesis 1. Because we have to see what happens when we don't receive grace and the natural progression of what happens when we don't receive grace. So starting in Genesis 1, we start in the beginning. We have a garden of grace. When you think about the Garden of Eden, I hope the first thing you think about, and I think this spring has been a perfect picture of it, when you go past these trees that are so full of abundance of blossoms, you can't see a branch. I hope that you've done that. I hope you've walked past and thought, could he possibly have fit any more blossoms on this tree? I mean, it's just abundant. That's a gorgeous picture of the Garden of Eden. This was a garden of grace. It was so abundant, so full of good things. And he said, I'm here with you. I'm right here with you. I love you unconditionally. And because I love you unconditionally, I want to give you the abundance of things that you need. Just abundance. And it just was everywhere. He said, look at all over and you'll see an abundance of trees. You can have it all. And it's all a gift because I love you so much. So he has, his presence is intimately involved in this garden of grace. And he's giving all good things for life. I mean, it's not just, I'm going to give you a tree that you can eat from. He says, I am going to give you this abundance. This just, you can have it all. It's just all there for you. Without you having to do anything, it's all there for you. This is what's good, and I just want to give it to you more and more and more. And then he gives them one more thing, and he says, and I'm going to give you the choice. Do you want to receive it? Do you want all this good, abundant stuff? Do you want it? So that's where we have Genesis 1. He has an abundance of beauty and nourishment and everything you can imagine. Do you want it? He's not going to force it to you. He doesn't force Adam and Eve, come and just eat of this, and I'm going to make you. I'm going to take you and put you in front of these trees, and I'm going to have you eat all these good stuff. He doesn't do that. He says, the other good thing I'm going to give you is a choice. So I'm going to give you a choice to receive all of that good. And what we have then with Adam and Eve is that they refuse the grace. They say, no, no thanks. I'm not going to choose what you offer to give me. I'm not going to choose the abundance. I refuse to take what you're offering me. I don't want it. Standing there in the garden full of abundance, and they don't want it. Instead, they say, I want to take what I think looks good. Not what you've told me looks good. Not what you've said. All this abundance. There's one thing out of this whole garden that I think looks good that you say isn't good. I want that. That's what I want. So I want what you're not offering. And so in taking and wanting what is not offered, they turn away from the intimacy and away from looking at him to what is not offered. That's the refusal of grace. And so what we have then in Genesis 1 really through 11, before we get to him offering the Abrahamic covenant, 1 through 11 is the progression, the natural progression of refusing grace. Most people will call that sin, but that is what sin is. It is a refusal of grace. And when we don't even quantify it as that, we begin to think that sin is behavior. And that is a problem when we think sin is a behavior. Because then, if it's just a behavior, we can manage that. But it is truly a refusal of grace. And there is a natural progression in refusing grace. Because in refusing grace, that will become systemic and it will grow. And this is what we see in Genesis 1 through 11, is the growth of the refusal of grace. So, when an individual choice will always affect the individual relationship between them and God. Always. It will always affect it. Because God himself is the giver of grace. And if I choose to refuse grace, then I am refusing God. No matter what it looks like, no matter how pretty it might look on the outside, it is always a refusal of the giver of grace. Just like when you refuse any gift that someone gives you, basically what you're saying is, you don't know what is good. You don't know what I need, what is good. You, in fact, aren't good because you just can't meet my needs. You can't meet what is good for me. And so you, the giver, are not good. And so that happens when each individual refuses grace, is we refuse that intimacy with God. We say, nope, you're not good. You're not good for me. There's other things that are good for me. You're not. And so what we have is Adam and Eve doing that. They hide from God. They refuse intimacy because they've chosen not what he's given. They've said, nope, we don't want that. We want something that you're not offering. So we want not you, we want whatever's not you. And so they hide from God, removing themselves from intimacy and relationship with him, basically life. Because in the garden, there was full and abundant life. That's what it was, and they refused to have full and abundant life. And they individually, both of them, both Adam and Eve, individually chose to reject the grace that God was giving them, the good that he was offering them, and take what was not offered. So, their choice, first and foremost, affected their relationship with God. as evangelicals, as Catholics, as whatever type of faith you have in the Christian gospel, we usually stop there. And we usually think that that's all sin is about and grace is about, is the relationship between us and God. The problem is that refusing grace always grows. It always grows. It's systemic. And so when an individual refuses grace, it affects his relationship with God, but that refusal at the personal level will always affect then the social level, relationships with one another. Because what happens is it will compel you to entice others to reject grace. Now, not outright. You won't be saying, oh, come on, reject grace with me. But what happens is you're alone. Once you reject grace, you just separated yourself from God. You want others to come with you because you were created for relationship. So it's just a natural, you want others to come with you. So it will compel you to entice others to join you in rejecting grace. This is what Eve did with Adam. Mm-hmm. Come, look, come here, be with me. How do we do that? Because we don't, we're much more subtle and sophisticated than Eve. We do other things to entice people. And the biggest thing we do is complain. When we complain and grumble to somebody else, what do we really want?
Sympathy. Understanding.
Yeah, come with me. Come with me. Join me in this complaining. I want to hear your complaints too. Yeah, I want you to get on my bandwagon. I want you to be with me because when I complain, I'm rejecting what God has given me. And since we've learned all through Hebrews that everything God gives us is grace, I'm saying, I don't want grace. I don't like grace. Come with me and say the same thing. Yeah, I don't like grace.
But there's something bigger than even rejecting grace going on, right? It is, we now define good.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in complaining, it isn't just like I reject that circumstance, but I am now defining good.
Right.
And you can agree with me, right? You
come define exactly.
Good too.
Exactly. And we have to do that because once we're outside of grace, we're like, I've got to get life here. I've got to say, this is good. This is good. So I have to begin to be the God, right? And so we entice others to do that. And so, and this is why I am always aware of when we call behavior sin rather than a rejection of grace sin. Because behavior on the outside can always be changed and manipulated and managed. So I can say, oh, because we can say right now, oh, I'm not going to complain. No, the point is not to not complain. The point is receive grace. You see the subtlety? And if you don't see the subtlety in that, once we get farther and farther out, it will be really hard to bring yourself back to, where am I not receiving grace?
And the other fallacy in that thinking is, I may really not be complaining, but I may not have grace.
Right.
So we may,
right.
Have, we
exactly.
may project a particular
yes.
behavior.
Oh, yes. I don't complain. Right. But
which
I'm still,
is something else when
exactly,
you say that.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And so we'll watch this grow systemically. So now it's not just affecting my relationship with God, it's now affecting my relationship with other people because not only am I enticing other people to come, like Adam, Eve did with Adam, but once I do that, once that we both are outside of grace, we're no longer unified. We're not unified with God. And so we're not unified with each other. Now we're strangers to one another. Adam and Eve now become strangers to one another because now that they're outside of grace, they have to find life for themselves. They have to find abundance for themselves. And so they are now, competitors. Yeah, competitors, that us and them idea. And we talked about this for a long time, the us and them. So now, once outside of grace, we're us and them. Wait, you have to get life, and I have to get life. Mm-hmm. And once I'm outside of grace, I am no longer in a place of abundance. I am in a place of scarcity. Mm-hmm. So think about this in the Garden of Eden. Abundant life, right? How many trees of good and evil were there?
One.
One. One, there is a finite amount of stuff once I'm outside of the Garden of Grace. And because of that, and now we're competitors, I have to get life and you have to get life. Well, now I need to get it before you do, or instead of you, because there's only so much. And so now we become not only strangers, but we become, one of us has to become a prisoner of the other. One of us has to be submissive to the other. In order for me to get this before you, I have to oppress you in some way, which is really what most board games are. Is if I'm going to win, and there's only one winner, I'm going to need to oppress you in some way, every other thing, right? So almost all board games are, even the simplest ones, well, if I oppress them by knocking out their marble, right, so I can get ahead, I win. So when I reject grace for myself, I entice others to, and then I bring them into a place of scarcity and a place of competition and a place of, now I got to oppress.
Well, it seems like that's the place where the definition of fair changes.
Yeah.
Too.
Yep, exactly.
You go from the most,
yes,
good for most people to the most good for me.
Right.
And it's not fair if I'm not,
right,
getting the good that you just got.
Right, exactly.
And that's where it seems to, like,
yep,
switch.
It really switches there. And this is what we see, actually, with Adam and Eve. What happens is, first of all, Adam and Eve begin to blame one another. We see particularly Adam blaming Eve for his problem, for his choice, and then blaming God for his choice. Yeah, right. So he blames everybody because, hey, I've got to oppress, and blame is oppress. I've got to oppress so that I can get on top. So that I can get life, because out here outside of the Garden of Grace, there is only so much life. And I got to get it. What happens for Adam and Eve is not only do they become strangers to one another and prisoners, they raise children outside of grace. And right away we see that Cain and Abel are strangers to one another. They are not unified. They've not seen unity in this marriage between Adam and Eve because they've chosen individually to not receive grace. And so there isn't unity with God. And so there isn't unity with one another. And so now they're spreading it to their children. There isn't unity with their children. And so what happens? What's the outcome of not receiving grace? In fact, Cain and Abel, they give sacrifices to God, and God says, oh, Cain, yours isn't what I asked for. Yours isn't the first fruits. You're giving me just some of. And what happens between, what is, so instead of Cain going, hey, this is between you and me, what does he do? Looks over to Abel, right? Mm-hmm. Well, wait a second. I need to be on top here. And so what happens? When God says that to Cain, he's offering him grace. Cain, you can come back. You can come back into my presence. You can offer your best to me because I'm offering my best to you. But instead he refuses grace and does what?
He kills.
When I reject grace individually, it will systemically grow into my social actions and I will begin to kill. I have to in order to get life. And we've talked about killing not meaning just physical killing, although we see that happening anyway, but it is killing with my words, it is killing with my actions, it is not giving grace to other people. And so, grace refused always grows systemically. For me to get life outside of grace, I know that I'm going to have to get it myself. Because outside of grace, things aren't going to be given to you. I mean, what's one of the biggest mantras? Nothing in life is free, mm-hmm. Right? Not true, but it is how we see it because we live outside of grace. If I'm outside of grace, nothing is free. It is all transaction. So I'm going to have to get it more and more. So we have a refusal of grace going from affecting my relationship with the grace giver to affecting now my relationship on the social level with one another, with other people. But it doesn't stop there. Because if grace is refused on the individual level, it will also be refused on the societal level. And when it's refused on the societal level, it will now affect the structure, the way society works. So it goes from the personal to the social to the structural. And it will begin to affect then how society works. So that two becoming one is no longer precious. It's not the picture of wholeness and fullness and life. Because we haven't seen it. And so that's not the picture of life. So it affects the family structure. And marriage now becomes two individuals maintaining their individuality and doing it together. Instead of two becoming one, and how often do we see this? That marriage, oh yes, yes, we're married, but it's still two individuals that completely say, no, I am an individual. And they hold on to that. And I've told you before, I've gone to weddings where the pastor actually said that. Maintain your individuality. And I think, wow. We have completely lost the picture of two into one that was in the Garden of Eden. Well, of course we have, because of the way that refusing grace always grows. And so that it's very hard for us to go back to that picture of what that really means, two into one. So it affects the family structure, and we become individuals that are living together. And so then society becomes a whole bunch of marriages of individuals, and society becomes individualistic. And so it's all about every individual getting life for themselves. And we have a society of competitors, a society and culture that says, I've got to get life, and you're somehow in my way. Think about the hardships in marriage. If I'm trying to get life, and you're trying to get life, and we're both trying to get life, there are times where you're in my way. You are an obstacle for me getting life, right? And that's where all the tensions come. You're an obstacle for me getting what I want, what I see is good. It's exactly how Eve looked at that. And what happens then, it affects a whole culture and political structure. Is, think about it. What does the country look like? The country looks like a whole bunch of individuals trying to get the same thing, and there's only so much to get outside of grace. And so it builds into the culture and into the politics of a culture what happens there. When we're all clamoring to get wholeness and fullness and life, then we're always clamoring to get more and better than someone else. And so not only does it affect the family structure and the cultural structure and the political structure, but it also affects the economic structure. So that our whole structure is to get more and better. And the whole way we live then is about competition and transaction and getting life for ourselves. And that begins to direct our activity. And so all of our activities of life are surrounded by getting life and striving for life and working for life. And we have the antithesis of the garden, which was a place of rest and receiving. And here we have work, getting, taking. For ourselves.
So, like, look, when you think about the curses, right? Like, for the man and for the woman, they were each basically paying for getting life.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
Essentially.
Yep.
Like, we're going to show you in your physical self that there's pain in having to get life for yourself.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So this is, so when he says a curse, it's, this is what you've chosen. You want this. You haven't chosen to receive. You want to work. You want to struggle to get life, whatever it is. You will always, Adam and Eve themselves struggled for control of each other. When it talks about Eve saying your desire will be for your husband, it's talking about desire of control. Your desire will be to control your husband because now you are strangers and competitors to one another. You will come together still and try to work together so that you get what you want. And how many times do we enter marriage? I married this person because he does this for me, right? And that's really, and when we enter marriage that way and we continue to grow marriage that way, it will always be two individuals together, not two becoming one. So it happens that with Adam and Eve, it happens with us. What happens in Genesis 1 and then Genesis 3 is Adam and Eve do this. They pass it on to their children. But then we go on to chapter 4 and chapter 11, and we see the population growing in disunity. They are more and more and more their own little islands. They're all individuals, not coming together. They come together for only one purpose, and that is to get something for themselves, to get life for themselves. And so we have that coming to, so we have, of course, Cain, and then we have the next person that Genesis talks about is Lamech. And does anyone remember Lamech? Lamech is the next person who murders. And he says to his children, yes, I've murdered, but Cain was forgiven, so I can be forgiven, so let's keep going. And keep going on and on. And Lamech is the father of Noah. And Noah is the time when God says the earth is just full of, as we translate, sin, vengeance, ugliness, murder toward one another, because they haven't been receiving grace, so they can't give it. And I have to stop this and start again. And so he brings the flood, he stops it, and he starts again with a family. And he starts with one family to try to grow it again. Of course, that salvation there is grace. And does the family receive it? I mean, what happens with Noah and his children? They don't receive grace, do they? Noah does, but the rest of the family doesn't. And we have all sorts of things happening until we get to chapter 11. And in chapter 11, we have the population has grown once again outside of grace, so that now we're a place where we are all individuals, but we're going to work together to do what? You know what happens in chapter 11? Yeah. Let's build us, and this is what they say. We always call it the Tower of Babel. Actually, what it says is, let us build for ourselves a city and a name. They had a place in the Garden of Eden that was God's city and God's name. But they say, let us build for ourselves our own city and our own name. And so they come together to do that for themselves. And in that, of course, we know that God confuses their language because this would be even worse for them to do. And he confuses their language. And what do? They start to group together again, not to be two into one. Let's all group as far as commonalities go. So you're speaking that language, we're speaking this language. Okay, so that means they're different than us. Now we have nations against nations against nations against nations, and from there on all the way until Revelation, we have this continual killing of one another in all sorts of ways. We have all these boundaries, and we only group to those people who are in some way common to us, not for the good of the common, but for the good of the individual, so I can get what I want. If I group with that common person, they kind of want the same thing. But within that group, let's think about your own groups, whatever groups you belong to that are your common groups. Within that group, how well unified are you? Is there any dissension within the group of commonality?
No, we found from leading trips with the Sierra Club
Yeah.
that usually
10 people, there was always one person that was a problem. And so if we could keep our groups to 9, things worked very well. And we actually had a backpack trip where we had 20 people. And so the leader, I was an assistant leader, the leader and I said, I think we can expect 2 problem people. And there were 2 problem people.
Well, I wish that were true, because then within families, and all but Carmel here has a family that's less than.
Well, I was going to say that, yeah, when we tried to plan like the 50th anniversary for my parents, it was difficult, you know, because a lot of people wouldn't give input, and you had to make decisions for something that big. And then once you started making decisions, the ones who would never comment started complaining about the decisions being made, even though it was all open to everyone.
Well, I mean, Adam and Eve show us that you really only need 2 people.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
You really only need 2 people for there to be decisions.
It always comes down to the individual. Because once we live outside of grace, we will always operate from a place of ungrace. We will always operate from an individualistic mindset, because that's what we know.
Well, we agree until you're not benefiting me.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Or we agree until you get to know someone beyond just a group, basically. So in a family.
Right.
You're forced.
Right, because now you are going to be stepping on my territories.
And Jill, I do have my example. I didn't really maybe want it on tape, but one of my cousins was in town, and it was nice to see her. And my sister and I met up with my cousin and her daughter, and we really haven't talked to her for maybe 17 years. For a long time, she lives far. And we just met yesterday, but I felt like it was such a competition. I hardly said anything, because my sister is very competitive and my cousin is, and that's like, oh, well, what are you doing? Well, I don't have much to say. My cousin's like, oh, I got a degree in this, a degree in this, and my sister is very much like that too. So they were going back and forth about their teaching and how many degrees they have and blah, blah, blah. And then I would get a word into my cousin's daughter, who I've never met, like, so what, you know, what do you like to do at school? And but I just felt like a third wheel, and I couldn't compete.
Wasn't that an awful feeling?
Yeah, I just couldn't compete with what they were saying. And then if I was telling her about, we have a big family, so about one of the cousins, she hasn't seen that. And she goes, oh, he's had 2 babies. And I didn't even get to say how they were doing, because they went back to her.
So it's funny that we call those kinds of things reunion. Because it isn't. We're coming together as individuals. And this is the problem.
It was very individualistic. Yes. And I was just kind of like ping pong.
Yeah.
Forward,
yeah.
But now, wouldn't you consider that now a gift? Because difficult people really are, it exposes something maybe in ourselves.
Yes.
So it's a gift, really.
Yes. And the gift is that it's offering us to come back to grace. Because when I can't see those as a gift and I can't give grace, it means there's somewhere I'm not receiving grace.
Okay, so when we're talking about refusing grace, I mean, there's a big acceptance of grace where we say, I understand what you've done for me and I accept it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a general acceptance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But don't you think moment by moment,
yes,
situation by situation,
absolutely.
I mean, I'd like to think, oh yeah, I've accepted grace. But I don't.
Right, right. And that's exactly the point of it. So we'll get there, and I'll give you a good visual so that we understand that. Because as Christians, we all say, we're grace receivers. We've received grace. And the gospel doesn't say, receive grace once. It never said that. It never will say that. It says, live in grace. Live in grace. Moment by moment, live in grace. Absolutely.
And Jill, you know, I was just thinking about the word grace, and you know, I bet you have a good little 5-letter acronym.
Well, what do we know is grace? We receive everything as a gift, we give thanks for it, and it spills over into rejoicing.
But I'm just thinking like the G, you know, God.
I don't do acronyms.
Next time we see.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because the truth will give you, be free.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first thing we have to understand is that when I don't receive grace individually, it grows. It grows. You can't stop it from growing except to go back and receive grace yourself. So understand that very essential principle, because it's exactly how Christ combats it and does the same thing. And so he goes back to the garden and he says, let's start all over again. Not with a family, but with an individual. Very, very from the beginning. So that in the beginning, in the new Garden of Eden, it's not a coincidence that Christ rises in a garden. That is very specifically meant. Look, we're starting all over again. This is the new garden of grace in my crucifixion and resurrection. He announces, and we talked about this last week, with a shaking. The shaking at the crucifixion and the shaking at the resurrection. He's saying, we are beginning again. I am shaking all things. I'm going to begin to shake all the things that aren't grace. All the things that you're striving for that don't belong in the garden, that cannot be in the garden because you've done them for yourself. I'm shaking that and I'm starting right here. And so I'm going to combat that refusal of grace with another offer of full grace to the individual, offering grace by an individual. And so he invites us, and this is Hebrews 1, 2, 3, and 4. He invites us to... He says, I'm recreating, Hebrews 1, with my death and resurrection, I am recreating. I am telling you, I understand, come back into my presence, come back into my house. I want you to be part of my house. I want to offer you all good things of life as a gift. Chapters 1 through 4 of Hebrews, that's all that it says. Enter this garden again. This is the place of rest. This is the place where you're going to be whole, and I can give you grace. So this is Hebrews 1 through 4 is the new garden of grace. And he says, and this is what we did last week, receiving grace means I return to his presence moment by moment, listening to his life and his shaking. So this week, every one of us have had his life speak to us and his shaking speak to us. You may not have been aware of it, but hopefully throughout all this semester, we've been practicing looking for where Jesus is presenting himself as grace. So, Kim, would you mind if you just share a little bit what happened to you? Because, Kim, I've been praying for this when it happened. The first thing I said, and I didn't want to email to you, say, you're getting shaken. What's going on here? Yeah. What happened to you?
My daughter and I were in a car accident on Thursday. We were rear-ended, and my jaw was hurt a little bit. My neck was sore. I've been dealing with other pain, too. So when I was checked out at the hospital, they gave me this muscle relaxant, and it actually healed the rest of the pain that I was having in my body. Mm-hmm. And I actually feel better than I have in probably 6 months. Because a lot of the pain is from a hormone imbalance. But this medicine led me to a pain doctor, which led me to feeling today, at least, better than I have since last August. And my daughter is fine. She had a headache the night of, but she's fine. And our car is messed up in the back, but the other guy's car is total. So, but it was. And then I went, this morning when I was getting ready, this is kind of the end of it, I was, I hadn't done my devotions yet. But I was getting ready, and I just felt drawn to go to my devotional, and I opened it up, and I started reading it. And one of the things it said is, to find joy in this day, you must live within its boundaries. And it said, I understand human frailty, and I know you can bear the weight of only one day at a time. Mm-hmm. And so I was like...
Exactly what we're talking about.
My natural inclination, yes, too, would be to go out and try to do everything that I haven't been able to do for 6 months. Uh-huh. And so reading this, I was like, it was like God drew me to read that because he slowed me down.
Yeah.
He just stopped me. Yep. And so it was very So I was glad I didn't have to wait a really long time to see the grace of what happened to me. But it's been a very, very good thing.
It has. And all of our shakings are good things. Whether we get to see him like Kim did so quickly or not, we can be confident that his shaking is actually a good thing for us. It may be leading us in different places. It may be getting rid of the things that we're not trusting him on. Those are good things. And so we say, we come back to his presence, and to receive grace, we stay in the moment. This is grace. You cut your finger. This is grace. I don't have to know how this is going to work out. I just need to know God is good. He gives us what we need. He shakes us and he speaks to us to give us full, abundant life. Whether we see it or not, it is truly grace. So I come there in the moment because grace is only true in the moment. Because when I am living in the future and the past, those aren't real or true for me. I have to live now here because this is where he is with me now. This is the only place I can be. As much as I want to live in the future or in the past, I can't be there. It's not true. It's not real.
We can see the grace after.
A lot of times. Yep. Yep.
To see the grace in it.
And that's the next point is, as I'm living there, let him change your sight. Yes, I can't see it. But when I live in the moment of grace, my sight begins to be changed. And I begin to see grace in places other people don't.
Well, Jill, it's a great example. You've often told us that, you know, other people can show us grace when we can't see it. And I had a situation this weekend where I was getting ready for two big family dinners, and I had a vase full of flowers all ready to go. And as I lifted up the vase, it separated and split and cut my finger. And I was all over the counter with all these marbles and everything going everywhere. And I was just, oh, and Amy looked at me, my daughter looked at me and said, oh my gosh, Mom, it's so good. It's what a great thing that you weren't carrying that across the room. It didn't fall and drop on your foot. And you know, I was like, oh, thank you. I mean, it was just
yes.
Right in that moment.
Yeah, right there, yes.
I was ready to, you know, like,
snatch
the piece, you know.
Yes.
She just stopped me from, it was just a really
yes.
wonderful
yes.
picture.
Yes.
That's
good. Right in the moment there.
Yeah,
that's
right,
that's really good.
But sometimes it's so hard to do. Like on
yep.
Sunday, we were in church and there was a family behind us. Their daughter talked the entire service. And John would look at me and I'd be like, don't. So I was so proud of myself keeping him down. But the whole time, I'm thinking, walk out with her. You know, I couldn't even focus on the sermon or anything going on because this little chatty girl, and then they had a son that was about Jackson's age, and maybe it was cultural. I know they were visitors because I think they go to the preschool program there because I saw the preschool director come down and I heard her welcome them. So I'm trying to think, maybe they don't go to church all the time, maybe they don't understand. And so the dad's explaining to the son kind of what's going on. And so the whole time, I mean, I couldn't tell you what the sermon was about. And I told John later, I'm really sorry because I was so busy getting on to you. And I still haven't let it go. I was so upset. And then we had a kid behind us crinkling a cup. And I was like, maybe we should have gone to sunrise service.
It was outside, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so hold that, because I want each of us to struggle with those places that we have a hard time giving grace.
Well, this last week, actually a few days ago, Paul's in Brazil this week, and we're in the process of working with our relocation company, and they're just a pain. That's simply true. And Paul sent an email to our contact person, and I sent him a text, so he had just landed. And as soon as he got off and his email synced up, it went. I saw it. I sent him a text and said, you know, that's great you sent that. I think you were way too nice. He sent me an email and said, you're right. Paragon stinks. Dom is incompetent. And I thought, that doesn't feel very good.
No. What did you just do?
You
enticed him to come outside of grace.
I enticed him to come outside of grace.
Uh-huh.
He was being gracious.
He was being gracious.
And it made me mad. And normally he wouldn't even write something like that, but I kind of think he was fed up with me. In a way.
He was just going to show you.
And I think he was just showing me. You're right. They do stink and they aren't competent, but I think his point really hit hard with me. Because I wasn't being gracious.
Right. That's right. And this is what I want us to begin thinking about is all of those times, why couldn't I be gracious? It isn't because somebody else did something. It's always because at the very beginning, I'm not receiving grace somewhere. I am not accepting what God is giving me as grace somewhere. We'll continue to look at that for a minute. But in receiving grace, not only do I come into his presence and stay there in the moment. This is where he's at. This is what he's giving me now. This is grace. This is abundance. I let him change my sight to see grace where I didn't see it before. And I hope that that's what you've been discovering as you're looking to stay in the moment, as you're looking at things as grace, your eyesight is beginning to change. You're beginning to see places of grace that you never did before. Hopefully that's what's happening. But in that, you then leave law. You then turn around and say, you know what? All of my attempts to control situations here, all my attempts to get good, aren't getting good. He's giving me good right here. I'm going to leave that. I'm going to leave law here.
I think sometimes you still might not see it, but at least like he gives you the faith and to know that it's going
to
come.
Yes, exactly.
Because I think sometimes you may expect to start seeing the grace and you may never see it.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
But you know it's there.
Right.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Well,
exactly.
I mean, you wonder if we walk by faith. And not by sight has a lot to do with that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what it
not
is.
Not so much like, I believe in God no matter what somebody shows me, but rather, I believe that this is good until it's revealed that it's good or something.
Right.
You know?
Right. Exactly. So, if refusing grace grows systemically, then so does receiving grace. It grows systemically. And so we have the antithesis of refusing grace. And this is what Jesus showed us in his life, in his death, in his resurrection. Hey, there's a brand new way to live life. You can receive grace. In the midst of this very life here, you can receive grace. And in receiving grace, the natural process will be for it to grow. And so as I receive it as an individual, it will affect my relationship with the grace giver, just like my refusing grace does. It's why Jesus says, abide in me. Me, be with me right here. Receive my breath for today. Receive my breath now. This is the only place that you're going to have life is my breath, not you trying to get breath. And when you do that, you will be fruitful. You will echo grace. It will just come out of you. It will overflow with the same breath of life. And so I have, and this is why I want to, Julia, it's funny, Julia, that you would bring this up because, of course, all I can think about is Julia when I take my Nespresso, which is her favorite, not my Nespresso, Bill's Nespresso. And just kind of give this picture. Because the picture we give people is receive Jesus Christ as Savior and you're set. We don't talk about living grace, mainly because we don't live it. And it's kind of hard to tell people to live grace, live receiving grace. So this is how we do it. We say, oh, receive grace. And so we take it from Jesus. We take Jesus' grace, all this water, the living water, and we put it into our lives and we say, yep, that's what it is. So now I can give it out. And it's going to come out and it's going to give me a nice cup of grace. And it'll work well. And let's see how many cups of grace we can get with the grace that I took. I forget that I'm tethered here. I know. Yeah. Julie is in heaven. Like, yeah. There's actually a capsule in there, but it's not a full capsule. And this is our life. We took grace from Jesus, and we're able to give it out. Oh, shoot. You know, I don't usually use these little ones.
It's overflowing.
It is overflowing. And for a while, we can keep that, right? We can keep it going. Oh, I can still give grace. I gave grace to that one person, and I just gave a lot of grace to that one person. And now there comes another person, and I can give some more grace to that person. Jill, you want to get, just bring me one of those other cups in there? I may have too much grace to give to others. And there are people in this room that people will say, you know, that person just gives grace all the time, all the time. Thank you. So I have more grace to give. And I just press my little button and I give grace, and, you know, it's not a problem. I just keep on giving grace and keep on giving grace, and I'm doing well, and let's see how much grace I have to give. It does smell good, doesn't it? Oh, what just happened? I ran out of juices. I ran out of grace. I have no grace anymore. And so we say, oh, well, you just need to go back to the fountain and get more grace and then put it back into your life and do that. And this is how we live. But then we always come to this point where we're out of grace and this cup isn't full. And that person really needed grace and you didn't have it to give. This is not the picture of what the gospel offers. The gospel says, no, you hook this up to the water that doesn't shut off. It's not something you go and get. It's someplace you live. It's a place that you live and not something you get. Does that make sense to you? I can give grace when I'm taking grace, but when I'm living in grace, I don't have to be the one to get it and give it out. It just flows through me. It just comes out and comes out and comes out. And this is what Hebrews has been saying and inviting. Come, live in grace. Not come and go. Not come and get grace and then go out in the world again and live transactionally. Because eventually those transactions are going to come out. Come and live in the garden of grace, in eternity. Come live here. Always living in grace, always receiving. Because then it just flows out of you and you don't have to go and come and go and come and get weary in doing that. And the reason, yes?
Sorry, I'm thinking of that thing I shared with you about the tree of life in the water. And how interesting it was that the Father who represented law, in every scene he was with water and he kinked the hose.
Oh, yes.
And in
the movie.
And every scene that she was in with water, the hose was flowing
freely. Yes.
And how even when you have access to the hose, there's still this choice. Am I going to let it flow?
Yep.
Or am I going to kick it?
Right.
Am I going to still try to control it?
Right.
So it only goes out when I say,
yes,
what I think is necessary. That person, okay, I can give it to. But that person, I do not.
And not only when I want to give it, but when I want to receive it.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I can do this one on my own. I am going to love that person.
Yeah.
No.
But I found myself more agitated and irritated, and maybe I gave grace to the last person, but it's like I'm out of grace, and it's so terrible.
Uh-huh.
But it's like,
yep,
wherever you go, you,
yep,
like a woman said to me, I got something at Sports Authority for my daughter, and she goes, no problem. I said, of course no problem. It's not a problem. I'm purchasing this because I said, well, I got cash. No problem. Of course no problem. Like, as easy as it possibly. Yeah. Like I don't know what to say. Because there's never a problem. I go to and thank you for this pain. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like all this people saying, oh, no problem. It's not a problem.
Jill, you did. You just told me exactly what this is. You gave grace, and all of a sudden you ran out of grace. And this is what you say. I gave grace here. I gave grace here. I gave grace here. And what are you saying? I gave grace.
Enough today.
No, actually, you didn't. Right. If I'm doing something, then it isn't grace. If I'm allowing, if I'm resting. See, the whole thing is I'm able to give out in rest. That's grace. And this is where we need to go back and begin to examine ourselves. When I don't give grace, I am not resting in grace. I am not receiving grace somewhere. And it's almost always corresponds to the exact same thing that you didn't give grace to. You didn't give grace to someone who didn't do a right job. You're not receiving grace because you're doing it on your own. You do service on your own. You do really good job of service. And you are a good service person. But if I'm a good service person, I'm not taking grace from God. I'm not saying it's
well,
God doing it in me.
Still on self.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When you abide, it's like a tree.
Yep.
It doesn't strive to bring
right.
forth fruit.
Exactly. Exactly. It just comes out.
And I think it's interesting, too. Like, when I saw Paul's email, I felt horrible.
Yes.
And I consider that progress.
Uh-huh.
Because I didn't
yeah.
know. Yeah, right.
right. Yeah, right. Right. It is progress.
You know, I mean, I didn't see it.
Yeah.
Good.
Yes.
He sees it my way now. I saw it as
ouch. Yes.
That's
yep.
what I said I wanted.
Yep.
And interestingly, he sent that email to me. He didn't send that to her.
Good thing.
Which is what I was basically saying.
Yeah.
It should have been
right.
more harsh.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And it's a when we see a reflection of ourselves not offering grace.
Yep. Oh. Yes. Yes.
And I think that competition comes out. Too,
yes, it
I'm
does.
I'm saying I would never be like that.
Right, that's exactly what you're saying.
I would be a much better
right.
waitress, or I would be a much
that's exactly,
better
yep.
teacher, or I would be.
Yep.
And you try
right.
and boost
yep.
yourself.
That's
up.
Exactly what it is. Yep.
Or I think sometimes it's I know that's where I fail too, and
I don't. I'm going to try not to fail that way.
Right.
Yeah.
And that you hold people to the standards, not only not that you succeed at, but I think the standards that you fail at because.
Right.
It questions your worth. And
yes. Yes.
You mean you offer them grace more readily? Or you
no,
don't.
You don't.
In areas that...
That you don't want to admit to where you fail.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because I think that's shame. And
yeah. So, now we go back to the Hebrews passage. And we look at what he says here. When he says, love the brethren, remember the prisoners, show hospitality to strangers. What he's doing is saying... Chapter 12. Remember, there's no chapters when the author wrote this. And he's saying, here's grace. Receive grace. See, everything is a gift. Give thanks. Rejoice. You've done that individually. Now allow it to continue to grow into the social level and the structural level. And this is what he has here, is he shows you the social level and the structural level as he goes into the first six verses of Hebrews. So he says, let the love of the brethren continue. He says, okay, so now allow grace to grow into the social level. You've done it between you and God. You've received grace. Now that you're receiving grace here, allow it to come out in the social level between the brethren. And that he says brethren specifically to say those people who are, have things in common with you. This is where you're going to start. This is going to be the easiest because we're in some ways unified in a family. If I'm receiving everything as grace, then my fellow believers I see as a gift, and I will treat them as such. Now, I mean, right away we go, oh, yeah, there's some fellow believers I don't receive as a gift, right? I'm sure every one of you can think of one fellow believer that you just have a hard time saying that's a gift. They're a gift. Then as soon as that happens, you go back, wow, what about that person am I not receiving grace for? Am I trying to strive on my own rather than let God give me life? But this is where he says, you receive grace, now you can start to let it grow. Let it grow. Don't force it. And we will talk about this forcing of it. To those who are like you, the brethren, they're gifts to you. And then he goes on to say, and show hospitality to strangers. Hospitality is hesed, basically. It's loving kindness. In other words, individuals who seem different than you, treat them like family, he's saying. That's Hesed. Treat them like family. Okay, so you have family. Give them grace. Now you have people who seem completely different than you. Treat them like family. Give them grace. Let the grace flow out of you. And then he says to remember the prisoners. And what did we talk about? When we're not receiving grace, we cause others to be strangers rather than family. And when they're strangers, now they're competitors, and now we have to oppress them, and so I'm going to make them my prisoners. So is the antithesis of what happens when I don't receive grace. And so he says, remember the prisoners. So it's not just the physical prisoners in prison, and it's not how some people interpret this. This is not the vocabulary he's using here. He says, because remember, you also are in the body. When he says the body here, it means your physical body. It does not mean the body of Christ here. So it is not. And when I saw a commentary that said, so you need to, you know, give grace to people who are in prison that are Christians. No, that is not what it says here. Prisoners. Because in prison, your body is completely affected. You should know. You have a body just like anybody that's in prison. And you know what happens. So I bet there are a few of you that know real prisoners. Anybody? Anybody know somebody who's in jail or has been in jail? Mm-hmm. When you find out what they go through, I don't care what they've done, when you find out the degradation that our system imposes on them, you're just taken aback. That cannot be. That cannot be. This is not how we treat prisoners. But you have to be willing to look at them as you. How would you fare in a place that completely looks at you as someone who needs to be oppressed rather than given grace? So he says, let grace grow systemically, relationally, on the social level. Let it do that as I give grace to people who are like me, that people who are not like me, and people who seem beneath me. And that's what we would say as to prisoners, right? Well, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't be in that situation. I would never be in that situation. I would never be a prisoner. How many of you ever thought, there is no way I would ever go to jail?
I am, but I don't want to raise my hand because I'm a prisoner.
Right? Right? I mean, okay, Carmel, can I bring this up again about the envelope?
Oh, sure.
And this is how everybody... So, we had a book club a month ago, and it was about, it took place in prison. And so the envelopes that everybody got had the real return address from the Federal Bureau of Prisons in Louisiana.
Addressed to
Carmel, and addressed to Jill, and addressed to, you know, all of these. And when Carmel went to put it in her recycling bin, what did she do?
She shredded it? No.
She tore the labels off. And I said, why? And she said, what if it blows away and people see that I have something addressed to me from the Federal Bureau of Prisons? No, this I love, because Carmel's willing to say, look, this is, and you know what? How many of us feel that way?
I did right? the same thing.
Yeah.
Somebody used my envelope. I put it on my door to collect money. I thought,
but you made sure you could take this. Yeah. See, the thing is, what happens is we don't receive grace for the places that we have oppressed people. No, I don't oppress people. But then it comes out. Yeah, you do. You do oppress people. You say that they're not you. They're not like you at all. They're separate from you. And anytime I say you're separate from me, I've lived outside of the garden of grace. I've lived outside of unity. No, we're all the same. We've talked about this a million times. We're all the same. All in need of grace. This is the place of life. Only the place of life is the place of grace. So that, remember, what did Hebrews say in chapter, was it 11 or 12? See to it that no one misses experiencing grace. See to it that no one misses experiencing grace. It doesn't say, see to it that none of your brethren in Christ miss grace. We'd have a hard time enough with that. But it says, see to it that no one misses out on an experience of grace. If I'm receiving grace, then I'm able to give out grace. Then my life becomes open to giving grace to all people, because all of us are needing grace. So if grace received individually grows into grace being received and given, if I'm giving grace, then there are places that it's received socially, on the social level. It will also affect grace and the way things are done on a structural level. So, let marriage be honored among all. As I experience unity in life, I give grace, I see us in unity. As we experience it as a society, then we begin to understand the preciousness of the picture of two into one. We begin to understand how precious that is, rather than two individuals. It's two into one that they become one. And we begin to understand that, and we uphold it because we know it reflects God's image of unity of two into one. And we encourage it wherever we see it, not just in ourselves, but in others' marriages as well. We encourage, we strengthen it, and we don't do anything to weaken it. One of the coolest things that I saw Yolanda do when she lost her marriage partner, the very first thing she did is she turned around and she began encouraging all the people she knew in their marriages. And she would say, cherish, she was so adamant, cherish this. This picture of two into one is what there is, the place of rest and joy and life. This is the picture of what God has given us. So that we're asked to do that in others' lives. So that we don't try to weaken it, but that we strengthen it. And we give grace in there. And we show grace. And we encourage and celebrate the grace in the two into one picture. So that our receiving of grace affects the individual, but it also affects the family structure. But it goes beyond the family structure, because then it says, let your character be free from greed. It says love of money, but the word is really greed there, of desire for more, and begins to affect the economical structure. As we experience the blessings of a real marriage, of a marriage where it's two into one, that they're growing two into one, we begin to understand that the picture of wholeness and completeness is dependent relationship, not independence. And so it affects then what I want, not things, but a dependent relationship. And as that grows, we begin to say, oh, I experience marriage as a two into one, a dependent relationship. I've seen it in places, and therefore I can experience, whether it's in my marriage or others' marriages, I can experience that. And I can experience also that there are places within that that need grace, but that I see grace given. I remember actually a Christian's girlfriend asked me, what's the best thing about marriage? And I can say at this point, after 32 years, the best thing about marriage is it is the place that I know I can get grace. It is a place that has been made a commitment that I'm going to get grace. Now, is it always grace? Nope. And it's been ugly at times, and it hasn't always been grace. But the more and the longer I abide in that, the more I see and receive grace, and the more I'm able to give grace. That should be the picture of marriage. This place of grace, not the place of competition, not the place of two individuals. And when I see that in my own marriage, when I see that in somebody else's marriage, it's enticing because it's what I've been made for. That's eternity. That's part of what eternity looks like, part of Eden looks like. And so I realize then what I really have is a dependent relationship in Jesus. I have abundance. Because this is life. And so it completely begins to change the structure of society from the individual receiving grace. And it goes so far as to actually affect the political structure, because the next thing of Hebrews says, so we confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man shall do to me. As a society, if we've been receiving grace individually and it goes to the societal level and it goes to the structural level, I begin to be content. Society begins to be content in a relationship, a dependent relationship with Jesus. They have no need to argue with one nation over another nation. They have no need to be a nation on top. They have no need for anything like that because they're finding life in Jesus fully. And they have no need to make a name for themselves and a city for themselves because they know in the dependent relationship with Jesus that he's building us into a city with the name, the only name that will last. And so what we see is that creation and recreation is still a process. It begins with the living word breathing grace. Jesus Christ coming out of that grave saying, here, I have new life for you. It's grace. It's a gift. Do you want to receive it? We go back to, we're Adam and Eve. We have this abundance being offered to us. And he says, do you want it? I'm giving it to you for free. Do you want it? So that it first and foremost must be received individually. It has to be received individually. Jesus says, I'm the vine, you are the branches. If you abide in me and I in you, then you shall bear much fruit. Because without me, you can do nothing. You can't give life if you're not getting life. You can't give grace if you're not living, abiding in grace. And when I abide in grace, it just comes out and there becomes unity. So that no matter if, let's say you're in a marriage and you're the only one giving grace, eventually grace wins out. What's our favorite bumper sticker? Love wins. Always. It always wins. It may not always look like it until later, but it always does. It is stronger than not receiving grace. Receiving grace is much stronger than that. And it will eventually bring unity. And in unity, grace is multiplied. And then grace is able to fill the earth little by little, generation by generation, restoring the garden into a garden city until we have revelation and the glory of our name. So here's the point. You cannot force these things. I cannot take chapter 13 and go to everybody. You got to love the brethren. You just have to do this. I'm going to force you to show hospitality to strangers. I'm going to force you to honor marriage. You cannot force people to do that. It's only by grace. And if we, the ones who say we receive grace, aren't showing grace, aren't giving grace in our families, in our marriages, in our families, we're not giving grace to the brethren, we're not giving grace to strangers, we're not giving grace to prisoners, and then we go out and say, you've got to honor marriage. You can't do it. It doesn't work. You can't force people to live in grace when you've not even received grace. It's ridiculous. We would never do that in any area of our lives. We would never tell somebody, you've got to do this. I'm not going to do it, but you got to do it. I have to live in grace. Let it flow out to my marriage partner, to my family, then to the brethren, then to strangers, then to prisoners. Then I don't have to say, honor marriage. I'm honoring it, and people go, oh, that just covers me. It affects me. I cannot force it. This is what happened in the Crusades. This is what happened in the witch hunts. This is what happens with terrorism now. I force someone into a behavior that requires grace. And what was our question? What happens when someone expects you to do something you're incapable of doing? It builds up resentment. It builds up resentment not just between you and the person. It starts to go systemically, and it starts to affect everybody around you. And so when I say to somebody, respect marriage, and I'm not giving grace to my marriage partner, what is happening? You're inviting and enticing people to live outside of grace when you're telling them that they've got to do this behavior. You're just saying, mold your behavior. Conform, conform. You're not giving them life. You're giving them death.
You know what's funny to me is that I think about this all the time. You know, I've run into a high school friend that had kids 10 years before I did. And her daughter's getting out of marriage already. And I think that young people, and listen, you could say, speak to this because you're in weddings like every other month. Young people still have that desire and that need to couple.
Yes.
And the need is so still even probably more prominent than ever. But everything else is more fragile than ever.
Mm-hmm.
That says, it's me, me.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the ideal or the fantasy of the coupling. But, you know, I mean, I think, my gosh, by the time our children are of that age, like, what's the divorce rate going to be then? I mean, I thought that whole idea of marriage has to really shift.
Yeah.
But unless they're transformed by God themselves, they can't give out. It will be individualistic. I mean, that's what we're seeing, isn't it?
But I just feel like, can we escalate any more to me, 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 me?
Mm-hmm.
Because marriage is going to last a month.
Well, and that's why they're shaking.
Yes. And that's also why God starts the shaking where?
With us.
With the church.
Yes, with the church.
The church must be shaken. Receive grace, he says in this shaking. Every time he shakes, he's saying, you're not receiving grace here. Receive grace, because if you don't receive grace, you as a priest cannot and are not worshiping, and therefore can't call other people into worship. If you aren't receiving grace, you can't be a priest. You're not worshiping, and therefore you can't call other people into it. So it does begin with the church. It does begin with us receiving grace in our own lives, living in the place of grace, living that says, yes, today, right now, in this moment, you are giving me an abundance of gifts. In the good and the bad, these are an abundance of gifts. And whether I see it or not, I say, yes, I'm going to stay right here. I'm not going to try to get out of it if it's hard. I'm not going to try to stay here and not go forward with you if it's easy. I'm going to receive what you have for me in this moment and say, yes, you're good, God. I want to receive it. I don't want to go somewhere else. I want to stay here. And in that receiving and thanking him for the grace, I begin to have a joy of life that just starts to overflow. And this is where I live. And this is what he talks about. This enduring and pressing on is not this on your own, get out and do it. It's stay in the moment, breathe with him, what breath he's giving you today, right now. This is so essential. It's why Hebrews is so essential for us to understand. If we as believers are not living in grace, we cannot be priests. We cannot call other people to worship because we're not. So, and this is what happens is we say, well, start with behavior. Let's make sure people know that this is wrong, that this is wrong, that they have to live this way. And God says, that's not what I'm inviting them to. I'm inviting them to receive grace, rest, life, all of that I'll take care of. I'll take care of what comes out of that. And what comes out of that will be behavior that reflects who God is. I'm not calling you to change people's behavior. I'm calling you to receive grace and let it flow out of you so that others can receive grace as well.
It's a level of vulnerability because I think about, like John has seen me at my ugliest, whether it be physically or emotionally.
Right.
And he's the one I can always count on to give me grace.
Right, exactly.
And it makes me think about, like, the book we're reading now for book club. People are in an earthquake in a basement. They think they're dying. They don't think they're going to be rescued. So they all tell these stories.
Yes.
And people tell stories that they probably would have never... Mm-hmm. Like, there was a grandmother and a granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And this grandmother told a story that nobody in the family or the granddaughter never knew. And it showed a vulnerability.
Yes.
And you think differently about these people.
Yes.
Your heart opens to
yes.
them.
Yes.
So just think about if we were all able to be vulnerable every day.
Yep. How many times? Right. How many times does Hebrews talk about us being naked, us being vulnerable? When I'm receiving grace, I'm completely vulnerable. I'm saying, there's nothing that's good about me. I receive it all. I receive it all.
Live as one,
or like I was working when I got married, and mm-hmm. we were both working, and then when we had a baby, we were competing for who's going to take care of the baby. Mm. I mean, you know, we both want to work.
Right.
And then, and I, you know, eventually made a choice to stay home with the baby. I mean, it was hard. And it's a good choice, but I become very vulnerable to my husband.
Right.
He has to provide me.
Right.
And now I'm at a point where I feel like, boy, I don't know anything I used to know. So many years ago when I was in the thick of technology mm-hmm. and doing all that, and on top of everything, I left it. You know, I shipped all that equipment back, and that's not my identity anymore, but I'm very vulnerable to mm-hmm. my husband has to provide for us. It's way
yep.
better for the family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like this, and you know, you get questions like, "Oh, well, your kids are big now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still providing."
That's right. That's right. That's
you
right.
You know, and but then sometimes you question, "Well, what is my work? You know,
mm-hmm.
should I get a job or go back?" Or and the time is it's not yet. But anyways,
mm-hmm.
it does make us very vulnerable.
Yep.
And for how many years? 17, 18 years. I have been out of the workforce. Like, ooh, you kind of look at. What value would I bring?
Yeah.
It's a vulnerable place.
Right. And if I'm looking at, I bring value because I do this, where am I? Outside of grace.
But,
yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of the,
yep.
the world, though.
Yep.
Kind of
it is. It is. And so what Hebrews is doing here in the first six verses is saying, look, when you receive grace, it will grow and affect the society you live in, the structure of the society you live in. You cannot go from step, you can't start in step three. You can't be a crusader for changing laws, going out protesting. You've got to start with receiving grace, and it will grow. God will make sure those grow. And you may be led to do some of those things, but if you do them without being receiving grace, they're going to be worse than not effective. They're going to entice people to live outside of grace, which is the whole point of you being a priest, is to say, come with me. This place of rest is fantastic. This place of grace is the place that we find life alone. I hope, my hope for you is that you do the homework. Because I don't go over talking about what it means to love the brethren, what it looks like, what it means to show hospitality. That's what was in your homework. But I want us to get to the basics of this, because if we continue only to see this is how it looks without seeing it has to start with receiving grace, we will always try to manipulate behavior, ours and others. What I want us to do then is to begin to think about the places that we're having a hard time showing grace to somebody. To a person, to a group of people, to a kind of people. I want you, I saw the greatest bumper sticker. You know those bumper stickers that are round and white and they just usually have a letter from a country? From usually, you know, it says, I can't think of some of them, but yeah, you know. Well, this one said, wrestle. Period. Wrestle. Mm-hmm. And I almost stopped the car and I thought, I'm sure that they are probably in wrestling or something. But my first thought was, wrestle. God wants us to wrestle with him. It's why he named Israel, Israel. To wrestle with God. God, and so I did this with this lesson. And it's great to have someone in the house that I can, you know, listen, I talk through the lesson. Here's somebody that I looked at, I met yesterday, and I thought, us and them, us and them. And we talked about it. Melissa said, so where in your life, what bothers you about that person? Where are you not able to give her grace? Where are you not receiving grace that you can't give it to her? And I really had to wrestle with that. Because it isn't obvious. We live so much on the top of transactions that we just don't even wrestle. And when I saw that bumper sticker, I thought, yeah, that's the call. Wrestle. Wrestle with the places that you can't give grace. That you have a hard time giving grace to people. That you have a hard time saying, I love you no matter about your behavior, and I'm not going to attempt to change your behavior. I just want to give you grace. And God will change the heart. Where are you having a hard time? Pinpoint that. And then ask, so what part of that am I not receiving grace in? Because almost always where you can't give grace, it's a place that you have been in control of your own life and not receiving grace. They're not doing this. I do that. I'm not going to ever be like that because I can do this. You're not receiving grace. If you can do it, you're not receiving grace. Jesus says in Philippians 4, I can do all things. And it says in, but do everybody remember what the real word means? Resting in. I can do all things resting in Jesus.
So kind of wrestle.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrestle with, where am I not resting in him? Where am I not living in that garden of grace?
The word wrestle is rest.
This is what I want you to do this week, is really wrestle with God. Because he is trying to shake you in those places. He brings you a person that you can't give grace to, that you're having a hard time giving grace. He brings you a group of people. He's going really lightly, I want this out of you. You need to rest here. You need to receive grace for yourself. And when you realize the places that you are trying to do things on your own, that you think you're sufficient in without God, he wants to wrest that out of you, because that is not living in eternity, in grace, in his presence. And he's trying to do you good. And he will continue to shake until it's out. And he's promised us that. That's a grace. The shakings are grace.
So, Melissa, what was your question to your mom? Because maybe this is one we can apply every time we feel that.
Yeah.
What you said about a person. When you said, what is it about
them? Oh, what is it about them that bothers you?
Okay.
That makes you look like they're not, that's not me. Mm-hmm. I don't like that because that's not me. And, you know, I'll tell you, when you wrestle and you actually come up with some things, you just stand in awe like, wow, that's true. That's true. And then all you want to do is fall down and say, I need grace here. I need grace. Mm-hmm. So, Father, we thank you that you continually go out to us to offer grace. And you go out to us with the voice of your life and the voice of your shaking. Father, I thank you that the gift you offer is for a renewed life, to again offer grace to us, that we might receive it, that we might live in it, in this moment, in the grace you offer. And we are excited and celebrate, and we are scared and afraid to wrestle with those places that are deep and dark inside of us. And we know that your desire is to clean those out and to bring us life, and most of all, to give us grace. May we be receivers of grace this week. In Jesus' name, amen.